Where and when you were born?
I was born on January the 19th, 1928, in London. My father was Harold Lewis and my mother was Thistle Lewis. They're both dead.
What did your parents do?
My mother did nothing except row with my father. And my father was an insurance broker until he left my mother. And then he became all sorts of things. He ran off with his partner's wife, which didn't help.
Did you know any of your grandparents?
Yes, I knew my grandfather and my grandmother on my father's side, and I knew my grandmother on my mother's side.
Did any of your grandparents work in the city also?
No. My grandfather on my father's side was an interesting character. He was a Polish immigrant Jew who came over here, and he started the world's first multiple tailing business before Burton's and went bust. When I knew him as a kid, my father was supporting him in those. He was a bankrupt.
Yes.
Lovely old man, smashing old man.
Would you say either of your parents had had any influence on you?
Influence in what way?
Either as an example to you, or they influenced you in the direction in which you took your life, or your attitude?
Well, my father did, I think, not my mother.
Mm.
No. My father was always interested in, he liked to play the stock market. And he knew very little about it. He liked to play the stock market. But that wasn't the reason I went in the city.
Mm.
I went in the city because basically I was cut out to be an insurance broker. My father had a big business. Mm. He was a senior partner of quite a successful company in the West End, which was taken over by one of the majors later on. I forget which one. And I was scheduled to go down as a partner when I was 21 in the insurance broking business. But he made a small error by running off with the wife of one of his partners, which was a big case at the time. It was all over the Daily Mirror and God knows what. He was sued for a very rare thing. He was sued for alienation of affection, which is a very old law, and he lost. And he had to pay £10,000 damages to his partner. Well, in 1950, that was a hell of a lot of bloody money.
Mm.
Hell of a lot. No, earlier than that, it was in the end of the war, before I came in the city. It was an end of fortune, and because he was quite a comfortable man, and it did actually put paid to my chance of a career in the insurance broking business. My uncle at that time, Charlie Smith, uncle by marriage, was the senior partner with his brother of the old. They were the original Smiths, and I'd never met him. And I suppose as my father felt we had to do something about me, as he'd buggered up my chances of becoming a partner in his business. So he took me to see Charlie, and he was a nice old man. I'd never met him before. And he said, would you give Tony a job? And he said, yes. And he must have thought, well, what the hell do I want this sort of pimply-faced, rather scraggy-looking guy in the company for? So he advertised me to go, put an investment in the Financial Times, office boy wants job type of advert, and he got so many answers. He was a funny old chap. He thought, well, if everybody wants him, I better keep him, because everybody was in the army. There weren't any kids in the city. I couldn't go in the army because I had only had one lung. I had a lung out when I was young, so I wasn't medically fit, and the war was coming to an end, so I missed my conscription. I didn't have to go. But there weren't any youngsters in the city. There were no office boys in the city in those days. So that's how I stayed with the firm.
Mm.
And he ran the firm during the war years and just after the war. And he died actually a short time after I joined the firm. He died. And his brother Morris, who was not related to me because it was his brother, came back, and he was a tough nut. I very nearly lost my job when he came in, because he wanted to put his nephew in. And the firm was very tiny. I mean, there were only about six people in the firm when I joined it, and there wasn't any room for more than one boy. But fortunately, I didn't. And in fact, his nephew lost his job instead, and I just stayed.
Let's go back just a little bit. What had been the attitude to money or the stock exchange in your family?
Well, my mother wasn't in any way, had no money attitude at all. She was a silly woman. And my father, I mean, I didn't have a lot of respect for my mother. She was basically not very bright, and My father was a financially orientated man. He was quite well off, actually, in those days, by those standards, as you know, not by today's standards, maybe. He was then, and he'd been a successful businessman. And I was very ambitious. I remember as a kid, I was very ambitious to make money one way or the other. I didn't know in what way. I'd never heard of the stock exchange until that came along. Mm. I had no knowledge at all of it.
Where did they send you to school?
Oh, I went, well, I was during the war, I suppose you could say. I was evacuated almost up to the north of England and to Lincolnshire. And then I came back and I went to Hendon Co-Educational School, which is in Hendon the Bell. And I did pretty well at school. I was quite, found schoolwork quite easy. And I wanted to go on to university on the physics side. You know, I was interested in maths and mathematics and physics. When it came to do my, in those days I had matriculation. I didn't have A-levels, if you remember, O-levels and A-levels. They had a matric and then a higher and everything. And I did very well at school. I was a top mark at school in the exams, but I only got a credit in physics instead of a distinction. And headmaster wanted me to go to Oxford or Cambridge under, with on the arts side. And I thought, well, that's not really for me. You know, what am I going to be after that? So I left school then. I didn't go to the city. I decided against the university degree because I really wanted to go and make money one way or the other, and I had no idea how. And when I got the job in the, well, I mean, I got the job in the city, you know, in those days you had blue buttons and things. I'm sure you've, other people have told you that. And it's my greatest ambition was to be a blue button to get in the market, and no idea what it was all about. And when I got my blue button, it was the only one the firm had because it was so tiny. I was just incredible. I just fell in love with it the first day. I thought, this is the place for me. I'm going to spend my life here. Just had marvellous.
Had you thought about any alternatives?
No, either four since. Never.
What about when you were just coming to the end of school? Were you assuming then that you would go into your father's business?
Yes.
Well, how would you describe Smith Brothers at the time you joined it? You've already said it was a small firm.
You see, it was a small partnership before the war. Of course, all the young partners were called up. And under the law in those days, if you went in the army, your firm was bound to offer you the job back when you came back. So if after I'd been in the firm, I don't know, probably less than a year, I can't remember, the old partners started to trickle back after the war. Of course, they all came back. I'd never met them before. And they were then about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Or eight partners, seven or eight partners then. And the office staff was very small. It was about half a dozen in the back office, and I was the boy. And I went and asked one of the senior partners, I think I asked Morris if I could have a blue button, and the firm didn't have one, and so they made me a blue button. And that was really the beginning of my life in the city, really, because that's when I got the stock market. I thought, this is absolutely fantastic. You know, this is buying and selling is for me. I just leapt it up.
Was there anything else that made you feel that was the career for you?
No, not really. I just loved buying and selling. It just seemed to me a great thing to do. I wasn't concerned about earnings, really. I remember when we first joined the firm and there was an office strike for more money. And one of the clerks came to me and said, you know, will you sign and everything else? I said, no. No. I was only a kid, but I thought, no. This is not the way to get on. This is not the way to get on. And I wouldn't sign. And they all lost their jobs, everyone, in those days. I mean, the senior part-time manager, I want my money, get out. Mm. Employed six more clerks. Mm. And I kept my job. I had no interest. I wasn't interested in what I earned at all. It didn't bother me. I mean, I started at 30 shillings a week. Mm. And that was roughly what I earned in those days for quite a long time. But I just loved doing it.
Can you remember some of your early impressions of going into the stock exchange?
Well, it was very difficult to understand it at first when you first went in. You know, it was very confusing. I've never been in a market before. It's a totally new thing to me, and it took me a couple of months to sort of get the feel of what was actually happening, because I wasn't trading, I was a blue button. I wasn't allowed to trade. You had to, in those days, be a blue button for 4 years before you were allowed to deal, and you had to be 21 years old. I mean the blue button in those days in the stock exchange was just about the lowest of the low. He was treated as a slave, really, but he was expected to learn the business, which is what I did. You know, I mean, it was a pretty rough life, very badly paid, and you're treated like dirt by everybody. But if you're any good, you learned how to deal. You learned the techniques of dealing by watching the guy you were working for. You know, I was posted in various markets working for different partners. And basically, I started in the gold market. That's where I spent most of my life.
What were the other markets?
We had a partner came back from the war who was a very, very clever trader, very unpleasant man, very clever trader. He's dead now, unfortunately, Sidney King, who eventually left us and went on his own. He was a very difficult partner, but he was a very fine trader, and he started the actual market in retail stores after the war. He was easily the biggest trader in the market in retail stores, like Marks and Spencer's and those sort of things, Gussie and Woolworths and all those sort of stocks. And then we had our gold book. We had two partners who came back from the war and started a gold share trading book, which is where I was attached to. And then we had a general industrial book that was like sort of things like chemical, ICI, and those sort of stocks, you know. We had two or three partners were sort of in general industrials. And that was about it. We were very small. I mean, there were a lot of jobs in those days. Must have been 200, I should think. Some of them one-man firms. Mm. And it's interesting, the gold market became very active shortly after I joined it, because the pound was devalued in 1949, and that was actually the year which I was made a dealer. I was a young, what they call an authorised clerk. I wasn't even a member, couldn't be. I was authorised to deal. And very shortly after that, the pound was devalued and the gold market went absolutely berserk. You know, we were trading out in the street till all hours of the night, and it was very exciting. And that was my first experience of dealing, really, on the firm's account. And I actually made quite a lot of money that year. Once I became a dealer, I was put on a sort of a percentage of the profits of the book. And I think my first year, I made £2,500 for myself, which was, well, in those days, it was an absolute fortune as my share. And the next year, didn't make a penny, not a penny. Gold book made nothing the next year. And I didn't make any money, I didn't have an income. Literally didn't earn any money. And I was double taxed. So what I'd spent and everything else, I was in dead hock at the end of the second year. No money at all, and eventually the whole thing was renegotiated, and I was put onto a share of the whole partnership books, you know, a small share.
How did you make ends meet?
No idea. Well, I think I owed money in the firm. I think I had a debit balance in the firm, from memory. I think I owed £2,000 or £3,000 in the firm.
Did you consider going out of the stock exchange and finding another job?
No, never. And it didn't even come into my mind. I loved the job. I wasn't actually very worried about it. I mean, I had a funny feeling that, which I've always had, I think, for being in the city and with this particular firm, I always had the feeling that if it went well, I'd do okay. I never actually sort of had any targets. I don't think I ever once in my whole life in the city, in this company, ever asked for more money. Not ever. Never, ever went to the bosses and said, you know, I must have some money. And it didn't occur to me. I was very happy in the job.
Now, what type of business were you doing in the gold market during those late 40s? What were the bargains like? Were they big bargains?
Well, it's relative.
Yes.
I mean, there wouldn't be big by today's standards. Then all money's been devalued and everything's been devalued. And they were big by those standards, but we were not a particularly big firm in the gold market. I mean, there were some giant firms by those days in that market. We were very much a small firm in the gold market. The difference was where we succeeded and in the end became the only firm in the gold market was because we were better than the others. Mm. We made money when they lost it. Mm. And all the major firms went out of business. Mm. Lazarus Brothers, Lehman Brothers, all Lorne Roos, all the firms that were much, much bigger than us when I joined the gold market. Either because we were cleverer or luckier or anything else, we traded very profitably and they lost money. Mm-hmm. They never saw they never spotted the one thing which we spotted a long time ago as a firm, trading in gold shares. It's a very peculiar market. It was a peculiar market because there's one thing you should always be when you're trading gold shares is short. You should never be long, because it's a sort of market where when they become unsaleable, they're unsaleable. But you can always buy something when it's going up. There's always a price somebody will sell something at. So although you may not make as much if you're short, at least you don't get catastrophic losses when the market collapses, as the gold market does regularly. I mean, it just collapses out of sight. And if you're stuck with stock, you know, you lose. That's what happens to all the major firms. They all got caught. And we carried on, and we always made money, and gradually and numbers of jobbers dropped out of the market, and the gold share market became very specialised. And we became the biggest player in it by far.
Were there any other distinctive features about the gold market again during the early part of your career? For example, I've been told that the gold market was one in which the shops operated a lot.
They did. It was a very there was no other market in the stock exchange like it. It was sort of market which it was punctuated by periods of great inactivity and periods of great activity. It was never a constant market, and of course the big mining shops did operate in the gold market in those days, very large. They still do now, but it's not quite the same. But they used to run the market in a sense, and we got ourselves very well organised with the brokers that used to operate for them, and we got some very big business from the mining shops. And I mean, there was insider dealing used to go on all the time there. I mean, it was part of the market. I mean, if the big mining shops didn't know what was going on in the gold mines, then nobody did, you know. And I remember some very funny occasions where you get orders from the shops in those days that, you know, which you, if you're intelligent, marked your card for you. You knew exactly what you were doing. It was in some times quite easy money. But the gold share market always had a tremendous air of excitement about it that the industrial market never had. The industrial market was boring, you know, in a comparatively.
Can you remember any particular examples of cases when you felt something was going on?
Oh, I remember one particular one, yes, where we had a very big order. There was a very, very, there was a great punter in the market. They used to sort of make a living in the gold market. He was a broker, actually, but he was a chap I looked up to enormously, who taught me an enormous amount about trading. Purely by watching the way he used to operate. He's dead now. He's a guy called Frank Bennett. He's a marvellous man. He was a very tall man. He had a bit of bad luck early on in his life because he was left to Burnley's in an arcade. So he wasn't exactly hard up for a few pounds. He operated for one or two of the mining shops. And he came to us once, I remember very clearly, he came to us and said, asked us a price, and he's still in a thing called Lorraine. And this Lorraine company had options. They had Lorraine options, as he called them. They were dealt separately, Lorraine options. And I forget the price of them. They're quite high. They were about 40 shillings or 45 shillings or something like that. And he said, I've got an order for you. He said, I want to sell Lorraine options. And I remember the partner I was standing with, Sidney Davis, who became the chairman of the company eventually. He was a very good jobber. And he said to him, well, what sort of price do you want to sell them? And he said, just sell them. And Sidney Davis said, well, I mean, do you want to take 30 shillings? He said, just sell them until I tell you to stop. Well, it was pretty clear. And they went to nothing. They absolutely went to nothing. And we just stood there, offering them openly and selling them. It was an extraordinary market. Because there's another thing about the gold share market which was exciting, was an open outcry market. Mm-hmm. You had to learn to put an offer openly, which you didn't do anywhere else in the house.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, for some reason, I don't know why, I think the practice grew up because when I was first started to trade, we used to trade out in the street after hours. And of course you shout and bids and offers, you know. And it's actually quite a difficult thing to do when you're young. You first start off, your first time doing it, then you get so practiced at it, you learn to run the market, you manipulate the market by bidding and offering openly. And it became a practice in the gold market. It was happened all the time. And that was all part of the excitement of it. Going in and bidding and offering for stock, you know, sometimes you're bluffing, sometimes you weren't, you know, it's all That was half the fun of the trading, really. Mm. I mean, you didn't go into Biffa stock when you had a buying order. You went into Biffa because you wanted to get it better sometimes and bid them up. And you know, there's a lot of bluff and counter bluff. It was a much more devious and subtle market than the equity markets were, which were much more straightforward. And
were there any characters in the market?
There's Frank Bennett was one, but there were some other. There were lots of funny people in that market. You know, some of them were not very successful, and they were very amusing. You start to remember some of the old guys. Some of the other jobbers were very amusing because they really didn't know what they were doing. Half of them, you could tell that they really didn't know what they were doing, and the way they tried to get out of business and doing business with you, and you know.
Again, can you remember any examples of that?
Well, I can remember the odd one, but I don't know whether I don't know whether the nuance would not be lost on you. You know, it's such sort of what you call parochial type of humour in those days. You know, I don't know whether it would mean anything. But I mean, you see, in the stock exchange, unlike the markets today, to the same extent, your word was your bond in those days. And if you made a price to somebody, I mean, you had to be on. There's no question of saying, oh, sorry, it doesn't suit me, or I don't want a deal, or anything like that. And, you know, we genuinely had to make a two-way price in those days, not knowing whether the man was a buyer or seller. And, you know, and he would ask the size, and you had to make it a certain size by convention, and you had to be on, whether it suited your book or not. It very often didn't suit your book. And then the skillful jobber was the one that was able to manipulate his book so that he got it right, by changing his price or bidding an offering or whatever, you know. I mean, orders very rarely suited your book. But you had to be on. You know, there was one character there who was never on. I mean, eventually they went bust. It always used to make me laugh. You'd go up to him and say, what a so-and-so. What a Ritz or something in the West Rand Investment Trust. And he'd say, oh, they're 3/16ths, 5/16ths. You say, well, I'll buy 1,000. He said, no, I didn't know you were a buyer. He sort of turned his back on you. It was all that sort of stuff used to go on, you know. I was in one funny occasion once, yes. We used to have a thing there in the market in those days where you used to have this makeup, what they called makeup day, once an account at the end of the account, where for the sake of the stock exchange records, whatever the stock finished on that, say, a Tuesday night or maybe on a Friday night, I can't remember now, that was like the going out price for the papers and for all the books and things. And they called it the make-up price at the end of the account, fortnightly account. And some of the jobbers used to try and manipulate the make-up price to suit their own book so that when they were going home in the evening, you know, the book was, that was in the right price, you see. That price, I always remember, there was a stock called Offsets, which stood for Orange Free State Investment Trust. And the whole market had stock. They were a lousy market. We had someone that we had, I don't know how many we had on the book, like 10 or 20,000. But they were high priced. I mean, you're talking something like about £5 or £6 a share. And George Lazarus, who in those days ran the gold market, he was much bigger than us, came across to one of our partners, Henry Marks, who eventually also became chairman of the company, and said, look, Henry, you know, let's try and get these offsets up a bit for the makeup price. He said, I'll bid for them, you see, and then you can bid for them, and we sort of bid against each other and just get the price up a bit. So Henry Mark said, okay, always prepared to help and get his own book looking a bit better. And George Lazarus bid 3/16 or something, and Henry bid a quarter. And then George Lazarus bid 5/16, and Henry bid 3/8. And there was a broker saying there who said to Henry, 5,000. He said, thank you. Bid it again, the broker said, 5,000. This went on about three times, and he sold us 20,000 odd shares, which is exactly what we didn't want. And so Henry walked across to George Lazarus and said, well, you saw it happen. He said, I had to take 20,000. He said, I'll sell you 10,000 of them. Oh. George said, no, I don't want them. Same as you, just a minute. It was arranged that we would bid them up together. If we did get these stock, we split it. No, he said, I don't want it. I've got too many already, and turned his back. I mean, I never forgot it. And you still, I still like the man. I mean, he was still a man who we used to get on with. But he was as crooked as hell. He eventually went bust as well. he was a funny man. He made a lot of money out of the devaluation in 1949, and they made a mistake of printing in the paper that Mr. George Rogers had made a million or something in trading in in gold out in the street. And his house got burgled the next day, and he lost a priceless collection of jade. I always remember that. He was a well-known jade collector. It's very funny. Yeah, but these things appeared very sort of funny to me at the time. You know, they're very much on the... You've got to be a market man to understand the sort of ludicrous humour. He's gone the sort of way that... I mean, there was the old story about George Lazarus. He used to have quite a big following in the Stock Exchange in those days. And he used to have his circle of friends who he'd put into things if he thought they were right, you see. I always remember one guy went up to him and he put him into something, a group fly or some rubbish stock. And nothing happened in these group fly things. And in the middle of the morning, the guy walked up to him and said, "You know those group fly you put me into this morning?" George says, "Yes." He says, "What's happened to him?" He says, "You haven't still got them, have you?" 2 hours later, a well-known story about George. But I think the gold market was certainly was more exciting than the rest of the stock exchange. And I think it also taught you to be very fast on your feet because it was such a volatile market. You know, you were trading with the whole world there. You see, you weren't in the equity market. You know, we were particularly trading with South Africa. I mean, there was a certain breed of brokers in those days in the gold market who arbitrage. You know, in those days you could arbitrage because communications weren't like they are now. There was no margins now, but in those days, you know, it was the first guy that got on the phone to the Cape and found out what was going on. There was very often a margin because we didn't know what the prices were. And there was quite a large sort of number of brokers who made their living by arbitraging between South Africa. And of course, you could get caught very, very easily because obviously South Africa, I mean, you see, the gold share market has been a professional market, it still is. I mean, if South Africa sells you 1,000 shares, it's far more significant than if some mug punter buys 50,000 from you. What do they know about gold shares? I mean, I remember when Merrill Lynch got out a circular once on some platinum shares. This is some years later. Merrill Lynch fancied themselves, you know, the Thundering Herd and all that business, and if they got a buy circular out on Lydenburg platinum, it's going to get, you know. And they came flooding in buying stock from us on the phone in the evenings here when New York opened. When we were sitting in the office, trading in the office after hours, Merrill Lynch came on and they bought hundreds of thousands of these Lydenburg Platts and we just kept selling them, couldn't have cared less. Because we knew, what the hell did Merrill Lynch know about Lydenburg Platinum? Because we had a small seller from South Africa. We knew exactly what was going on. One of the shops was selling them, just letting a few go here and there. It's good enough for them to sell them, then it doesn't matter how many Merrill Lynch buy, they're going to be wrong. And they were. They were terribly wrong. It was a very professional market, and you had to know you had to have your contacts, and you had to. I went out to South Africa once or twice later on in later years, and met the shops out there, and went down, you know, saw the mines and things. In those days that we're talking about, I was too young. I mean, the senior partners used to go out there, and we got some tremendous contacts. We made a lot of friends in South Africa, and it all contributed to our strength in that gold share market. Mm. And the gold share market built this firm up, really. Mm. That was we're the mainspring. We made all the money. Mm. The equity market was, well, Sidney King made a bit in the stores. He was a very clever jobber, and he built up a very big market in the stores. Mm. But the rest of the firm didn't do much, really. The impetus of all the income, I would say 70% in those early days came from the mining market. Mm.
Why had the partners originally got involved in that market?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it goes back, you see, before the war. I mean, when Maurice Smith was the senior partner with Charlie, and Charlie was really a very nice man, but he wasn't much of a trader. He was too interested in dealing PA all the time without trying to do anything for the book. And Maurice was a very shrewd trader, very tough man. And he started trading in the gold share market. And I think what happened was that the younger guys who joined the firm before the war and eventually came back as partners after the war worked for him in that market, and they just learned to trade in that market. In particular, there were three. There was a guy called Simmons, who wasn't one of the original ones, but he came to us after the war. He came from a broking firm. He was also a very fine trader. He was dead. And Sidney Davis and Henry Marks, who were great friends, and they joined the firm as kids before the war, both in the mining market with Morris Smith, and they came back as partners. And the mining market was in two markets in those days. There was what they called the Deep Market and the Orange Free State Market. And they were, each of the partners ran their book in. So we had two mining books, and I stood with both of them at times, various times, before I became a trader. And then when I traded, I stood with Sidney Davis, who was of the two far the better jobber, far the better trader, very, very, very intelligent trader, very logical trader. You had to have flair. I mean, it's a funny business. You see, this is what missing today, because it's just different. I'm not saying it's any worse or better, but it's different. You had to have a flair in those days for the feel of a market, which you can only do when you're in a marketplace.
Now, how did you feel when you became authorized? Did you feel ready for it? Did you feel you could
make prices? Oh, yes, I was raring to go. I'd already been trading unofficially as a blue button even, times.
Did a lot of that go on?
Yes, a little bit. Not a lot. No, not a lot. A little bit. It depends on the individual. I mean, by that time, we had other blue buttons in the firm, and they certainly were not allowed to trade. Mm. I was the senior blue button.
How would it happen?
Well, Sidney Davis would go off for the afternoon or something, and he'd leave me with the book. And, of course, you got into trouble if you were caught trading. But people who I would, you know, by that time, I really had a... was quite well known in the traders in the market there, and they didn't object because they knew that the firm would stand by any deal that I did.